Today is Monday, April 3rd. We're going to work on some urinary system information and then open the class for review. Okay, so we're on page 105, blood supply to and from the nephron. And what I'd like to do is just walk you through the process of getting blood into the kidney and out of the kidney. I want to preface this by saying, though, that any textbook you pick up with kidney information in it is going to give you a different flow pattern. I don't know how many textbooks I've seen that say, this is the flow pattern, they give you one set of vessels, and then another book will give you another flow pattern completely different. They do agree on renal artery taking blood in and renal vein taking blood out, but there seems to be quite a bit of variability and lack of agreement on what happens after you enter into the kidney. So just wanted to give you a heads up there in case you see other textbooks. Well, the renal artery branches off the aorta. It takes oxygen and nutrient-rich blood into the kidney, and it will branch into around 5 segmental arteries. These segmental arteries will then branch again into a set of vessels known as what? Good, interlobar arteries. And these arteries are now taking us out along the edges of the pyramids, and then we have a set of vessels that are found out closer to the edge. These are sitting at the bases of your pyramids, and they're called what?
Arcuate.
Arcuate, good. So in this big picture, every one of these pyramids has an artery wrapping its base. These are all arcuate arteries wrapping the base. And each of those arcuate arteries has little tiny branches coming off called?
Cortical
radiate, good. So these coming off the edges here are cortical radiate arteries. Older textbooks call the cortical radiates interlobular. I don't know if you want to use that word because it gets confusing. You've got interlobar, and then you'll have an interlobular if you choose to use that word. That's a point for confusion. It may simply be easier to say we've got renal, segmental, interlobar, arcuate, cortical radiate, and that way you don't have a confusing set of terms there to work from. Let's take a look at this picture. You can see the arcuate artery sits at the base of the pyramid, and then we've got the cortical radiates that branch off, and those cortical radiates give rise to a set of capillaries, this set right here. What are they called?
Glomerulus.
Glomerulus, good. Those glomeruli are the little teeny tiny capillaries where we're going to have filtration take place. So from the cortical radiates, we give rise to a very small arteriole, afferent arteriole. We filter here at the glomerular capillaries, and then we flow away by way of an efferent arteriole. So these arterioles oddly drain and feed a capillary bed. You know, that's not the normal case. What normally drains a capillary bed? Venule, right. So a little odd setup here. We've got arterioles feeding into the capillary and an arteriole draining away from that capillary. All right, so that efferent arteriole forms this set of peritubular capillaries. The word peritubular implies that we are wrapping around those tubules, and that, of course, is where they're located. Peritubular capillaries will then flow over this way and form a venule, which we don't actually have a name for. It's right there. And it joins this cortical radiate vein. From the cortical radiate vein, where do we go next? We go to this vein here called?
Arcuate
veins, good. Those arcuate veins will flow back into interlobar veins. And then notice there is no segmental. And so where do we go next?
Renal
vein. Yeah, so we actually don't have a segmental vein on the exit pathway. We only have segmentals on the artery pathway coming in, none on the exit route out. So if you're trying to keep this stuff straight, there's actually 5 arteries coming in. There's only 4 veins on the exit pathway. Keep in mind there is no segmental vein on our flow out pathway. Something else to keep in mind here that's a rather odd flow pattern. Once you branch off the cortical radiate artery and you're heading to the glomerulus, you travel through the afferent, there it is with an A arteriole, you go through the glomerulus, and then you exit by way of an efferent arteriole. So keep in mind, if you're thinking normal flow pattern here, we actually don't have a venule as we exit the glomerulus. We have rather an arterial coming off that glomerulus. Okay. So I just want to hit that flow pattern. I know that those of you who had lab this morning, you probably hit that today, right? Okay. How about any questions on this flow pathway? Take a look at the bottom of the page. You'll notice there are four pathways down there. First one says, trace the pathway of a red blood cell from the renal artery to the renal vein. Well, it's the one listed here on this page. So page 105 has that flow pathway from the renal artery to the renal vein. All you do is just list it straight down that list that's on your page there. So we won't worry about that for Wednesday's test. That'll be something we worry about for test number 4. Any questions on that flow path?
Would that be an essay?
It would be an essay, sure would. Yeah, on test 4. I'd like to get you just a little bit into renal function, and that takes us to this stuff here. I want to look really closely at the glomerulus, because on page 106, you'll notice this is the site for filtration. So what are we filtering?
Blood.
Filtering blood, good. What are we doing with that blood that we filter? Good. We put the good stuff back in systemic circulation, and the waste products, where do they go? Out of the body is urine. Good. So the first step in deciding what is good and that we want to keep versus waste products to get rid of is we have to take the plasma out of the bloodstream. Why do we not filter out the blood cells?
You need those,
right? There is no point in making the decision here in the kidneys about which blood cells to keep or to get rid of. Where are blood cells filtered? Yeah, the liver or the spleen. So you're right. This is not the time or place to filter blood cells. This is where we're going to filter the blood plasma. So this filtration process in the glomerulus is only going to remove blood plasma and not those blood cells. So let's talk about the filtration process. These glomerular capillaries have strange-looking cells here called podocytes. These podocytes look like little octopus. They have these little branched arms that wrap around your capillary, and they create a very porous set of capillaries. That's great if you're trying to squeeze out fluids and electrolytes, waste products, even good stuff like glucose. You can squeeze them through the walls of those podocytes and then capture them here by this Bowman's capsule or glomerular capsule. The benefit of using these podocytes is they're not going to let the big stuff through like blood proteins and blood cells. So we've got a very porous setup for our capillaries, but we're only letting out the small stuff that's dissolved in your blood plasma, not big stuff like blood cells and blood proteins. So if you notice, we've got a setup here where our DCT or distal convoluted tubule travels right nearby. Wedged between your DCT and the two arterioles that feed and drain your glomerulus is a specialized set of cells. What's the name of those special set of cells? Yep. Juxtaglomerular apparatus is it, or you can call it what for short? JGA for short. Good. So that JGA setup right there is monitoring blood pressure. And that JGA has a specialized set of cells that pick up on blood pressure. If your blood pressure is too low, you can't form filtrate. So thinking back to our earlier discussion, what type of pressure pushes fluids out of capillaries? Hydrostatic, yeah. So you gotta have hydrostatic pressure to force fluids out of capillaries. Hydrostatic pressure and blood pressure are the same thing. So if you've got low blood pressure, what do those JGA cells release? Renin, yeah, they're going to release renin. Let's get you a picture there. So with renin, they now have set into motion the renin angiotensin mechanism, and now you release angiotensin by your liver, convert it to angiotensin 2, and that turns on which hormone?
Aldosterone.
Aldosterone, right. We come back full circle. Aldosterone targets your DCT, tells your DCT to reclaim more what? Water and salt, yeah. And so how does that help your problem?
Increases
blood pressure, good. So we come full circle. We now can make filtrate because we have enough fluid in our bloodstream to push fluids and plasma out of our blood and into that glomerular capsule. So that's the goal here, is we're trying to encourage fluids to be pushed out, but you got to have normal blood pressure, or at least enough blood pressure to be able to force out those fluids. So let me tell you about this NFP term in the middle of your page. That's middle of 106. So I'd like to take a look at this picture. Okay, so there are three pressures here, not two pressures, that are battling to force filtrate or blood plasma out of your bloodstream. So our job at the glomerulus is to filter the blood plasma. The first pressure we're going to look at is hydrostatic pressure. That is the same thing as blood pressure. You'll notice it's actually pretty high here, around 55 millimeters mercury. So we're pushing out with 55 millimeters. When we studied this, we said that most capillaries had a force or a push of about 35. So right now we're already dealing with a higher pressure. That's thanks to an arteriole that feeds and drains that glomerular set of capillaries. So the fact that we have arterioles on each end of our glomerulus means that we can maintain an even higher pressure than normal. You'll notice that osmotic pressure here is going to be pulling in with a pressure of around 30 millimeters mercury. That's a little higher than normal too. We normally talk about that being around 26 millimeters mercury. So if that alone was the battle, we would see that we could push fluids out of our glomerulus and into the capsule with no problem. But there's actually a complicating factor here. Whatever you push out is captured by this capsule. So the fluid sitting in the capsule creates hydrostatic pressure, and that's pushing back into the glomerular capillaries with a force of about 15 millimeters mercury. So we're actually pushing in with 15. Have I lost you anywhere? Okay, so we're pushing out with blood pressure, 55. Osmotic pressure is pulling in with 30, and the fluid that got pushed out is now sitting out here in the capsule trying to get back in. Excuse me. So we've actually got this battle set up. If you do the math here, 55 minus 30 is 25, okay? And then 25, I'll just add that in here, minus 15 is only 10 that you're able to push with. So all this battle, and you're actually only getting a net filtration pressure, which is an overall push of 10 millimeters mercury at that glomerular capillary. Okay, and that's your overall push. Your overall pressure in the glomerulus, that's really what you're effectively able to push out those fluids and form filtrate with, is 10 millimeters mercury. You okay with this? You'd like me to run through it again? Again? Okay, I had a couple yeses out there. So hydrostatic pressure pushes, osmotic pressure pulls. That's an old familiar story. So we're pushing out with 55, we're pulling in with 30. If you just based on those two pressures alone, you'd be pushing out with a force of 25. Keep in mind that 55 is the greater number, so it wins the battle. So just based on those two numbers alone, we're forcing out with a push of 25 millimeters mercury. We're actually pushing in with hydrostatic pressure as well. You know, when you force the fluids out of the glomerular capillaries, those fluids are sitting inside this capsule. and they're trying to get back into the capillary. So the force of pushing back in is 15. If you do 25 push out with 15 pushing in, now we're left with only an ability to push out with 10 millimeters mercury. Okay, so the bottom line is you don't need to know these individual numbers, just this one here, that our overall force of filtration is around 10 millimeters mercury of pressure. And I want to make the point here about all these pressures playing a role. If you have anything that upsets the pressure balance, you may not form filtrate. And why is that a bad thing? You could have excess fluid. Sure, what else could be a problem? Edema, sure can. You could keep all your waste products that you should be urinating away. So we certainly want to filter this stuff out, and that's why maintaining blood pressure is so important here. And it's also why we've got that JGA sitting right next door to help increase blood pressure if it happens to be too low. So that's why all of this setup here to maintain blood pressure is so critical. We've got to form filtrate to get rid of waste products. I can talk, I need to go back home today. Okay, so filtration occurs here in the glomerulus. You capture it by that capsule. That capsule is called the glomerular capsule or Bowman's capsule. Let me give you a different way to think about this. You ever make spaghetti in a pot, hot water, boiling hot water, spaghetti's done. You might get out a colander, which has a bunch of holes in it. You might sit that in your sink, and then you pour the entire pot of hot spaghetti and water into that colander. So what's the plan? What do you hope escapes through those holes? Because it's tiny enough, right? It's wet, right? And of course, what do you hope to keep behind in your colander? So why do you want to trap the noodles?
You
want to eat them, and they're big enough, right? Okay, so that's the concept here is you trap the noodles, you trap the blood cells, they're big enough. Everything else gets to travel through the tiny holes, and those tiny holes are these podocytes on that filtration membrane. So it's a way for us to basically let things of a certain size pass through and be filtered, and then from the point that they're filtered, they will travel down that PCT and start the process of sorting. So we'll eventually decide what we want to keep and what we want to get rid of. All right, near the bottom of your page, let me introduce a concept called GFR, or the filtration rate. If your blood pressures are normal and you're able to form filtrate, you know, pushing out that fluid across the wall of your capillaries, then we expect you to be able to filter at a particular rate. And the rate is you're able to filter 120 milliliters of blood per minute. Okay, so the typical glomerular filtration rate, if you've got normal blood pressure, is that you're able to filter around 120 milliliters of blood per minute. So no one goes in for a kidney test to see if you can filter blood that fast every minute. They may do it over a certain number of hours to see if you're effectively filtering and removing waste products from your bloodstream, but it's based upon this filtration rate per minute. So, you know, no one's going to pee in a cup, all right, drink, now pee, you know, 1 minute later. No, it doesn't happen that way, but of course it's based on 120 mils per minute. So if you happen to have a glomerular filtration rate lower than 60, that is 50%. That's half of what you should be filtering every minute. What could ultimately end up in your body if you have a half of the filtration rate? Toxins, waste, extra fluids, okay? So if you're only filtering at a rate of 60 milliliters per minute, we say that's now an area for kidney disease, and you can even run down as low as 15, and at that point we say a person's in kidney failure. And that means that we're now not able to exclude any toxins from the bloodstream. Those waste products build up in the blood, and we have edema from having had all those excess fluids build up. So 120 is the ideal number. 60 or lower is disease. 15 or lower then runs into kidney failure. And then last on that page is something called clearance. Assuming that you have normal blood pressure and assuming that your filtration rate's 120 milliliters per minute, you should be able to clear toxins from your bloodstream. If you're suspected of having kidney problems or kidney disease, they can even inject a particular product like inulin or creatinine, and they can time how long it takes for you to filter that out of your bloodstream. So the clearance rate should be based upon your filtration rate, and it should hopefully remove those waste products from the bloodstream. You know, usually the timing is a minute, but like I mentioned, they're not going to say, okay, inject it, go, let's see if we can get it out of your system. They'll give you some bigger time period, like an hour or several hours, to clear that stuff from your bloodstream. All right, so that should wrap up page 106. How about questions on that page? That's kind of where I wanted to get you today, is at least to page 106. That leaves me 107 through 109 to finish. Short chapter, right? And then there's some 112 to 115 information that's kind of like a read at home. I normally don't do that in class if we're cut for time. We may have time to do those pages this semester, but that's a doable amount that we can finish up on Monday. So what I'd like to do is turn the class over to you, and let's hit questions for test number 3. Yeah, let me hit that chart just to review that for you. All right, the question was about page 78, the top of... Sure. Hyperventilation cause, I'm not asking you to compensate, so you're right, look for those keywords. I may say to you, I've got this problem, how do we fix it, how do we compensate? Yeah, there's good clue words like that to look for, yeah. And then for that chart, yeah, the stuff that's in red is the only thing that you need to know, besides appreciating the trend of oxygen flowing in and CO2 flowing out. Each gas is part of a mixture or a whole, and each one exerts its own pressure. It's different from Boyle's law, which is the pressure and volume variable that drives respiration, breathing in and breathing out. So that's, I typically don't ask much about Dalton's law, if anything at all, in this test. Just know those numbers. I may ask you where oxygen partial pressure is the highest, and I may give you systemic capillaries, aorta. I may give you some choices like that. Of oxygen, you'd look at veins, you'd look at alveoli, pulmonary veins. Since you've performed the gas exchange, there's going to be a lower partial pressure there. Partial pressure of oxygen is highest in your pulmonary capillaries, aorta, arteries, where your blood is red.
As long as for your blood is blue.
For the numbers, you're looking more of like,
that's right, yes. So the out of range of the normal limits. All right, watch y'all's next question.
What did you say it was the lowest?
For oxygen, think about your blue pathway, venules, veins, vena cava, right side of the heart, pulmonary trunk. Those are all going to be lower O2 levels than the red flow pathway.
So I guess, is there a CO2 to that, where it's probably
the
CO2 highest
or
CO2 lowest?
Yeah, CO2 is going to be higher in that blue pathway where you're picking up CO2 from the capillaries and venules and veins.
And that's where
that's right.
It's like the opposite.
It's opposite, yeah, sure it is. The lowest PCO2 would be something like you coming back from the lungs to the heart, something like pulmonary veins. Aorta has low PCO2. Arteries have low PCO2 because you're not picking it up yet. Another good thing to review is this oxygen hemoglobin dissociation curve. And if you want to find that in your course pack, it's bottom of 79. There's even some info with some practice on page 80. So to appreciate this curve, we're looking at the opportunity for oxygen to bind to hemoglobin, or we're predicting if oxygen and hemoglobin will break up. So it's kind of like predicting if they're going to stay together or break up. And the curve, you'll notice, is a gentle S-shaped curve, and that has to do with how well oxygen and hemoglobin like each other. In other words, they have an affinity for one another. If you have two oxygens bound to hemoglobin, it makes it easier for three to bind or four to bind, so that's why you've got a gentle S-shaped curve. Let's see, a number to know here, of course, is 60 PO2. That's going to be a critically low number on the oxygen level. At what point or what problem do we emerge with there?
Hypoxia,
right. And then, of course, we think about the three lines on this curve. The middle of the three lines means that we're dealing with normal body temperature, normal CO2, and normal pH. If we are hot, we're exercising, we have excess CO2, now which line do we shift off to? Shift to the right. And if you're cold, alkalosis, resting, shift to the left. Yeah. So we have to keep in mind those kinds of clues so we know which of the three lines to go to. So let's talk through a normal scenario. Let's take 60 millimeters mercury, and let's say that we have normal body temperature, normal pH, normal everything. So at what is our percent saturation at a PO2 of 60?
80.
Somewhere in mid-80s, what I'm getting from you?
Upper
80s. Okay. So which line did you go to from 60?
Middle line.
Middle line. Yep. So you come up to that blue line. When you came across, you were somewhere in the middle upper 80s. So we're looking at pretty good saturation, even though we're hitting hypoxia at 60. Let's do this. Let's say that you're at 60 and you're exercising, your body temperature is increasing, your CO2 levels increase. Now, which line do we use? The right one. Okay, so now what would your percent saturation be?
82.
About 82. So would you say that we have decreased or increased our percent saturation through exercise?
Decreased
it. So what happened to all the oxygen? Used up. Yep, it got pushed out into the cells and tissues through diffusion, and of course it uses it to make ATP. Let's say that you're resting and cold with a PO2 of 60. Now which way do you shift?
Upper
to the left, to the green line. And what happens to your saturation? Goes up into the 90s. Yeah, it looks like in the mid-90s maybe. Okay, so cold, alkalosis, low levels of CO2 will shift you in what direction? To the left. What will shift you to the right? Good. Increased body temp, increased pH, and decreased pH and increased CO2. So basically exercise will shift you to the right and rest will shift you to the left. Let's do another one on here. Let's take a PO2 of, that one looks like about 51. What happens if we are exercising and hot? What is our P, our percent saturation? Shifts to the right, good. Estimate a number for me if we're 51 and exercising. 75, mid-70s, that looks good, okay. And then if you are now in alkalosis, but at PO2 of 51?
82.
If you're in alkalosis in 51, let's see. Looks like closing in on 90, upper 80s to 90. Yeah, so big difference there if you swing from being hot and exercising to cold and alkalosis on the other side there. So
would you just like,
I'll give you a number on this scale, and I'll tell you I'm hot, I've got alkalosis, acidosis, I'll give you some condition. I may say I'm normal, so you just have to pick the one of the three lines that it matches and then read across to the percent saturation. Okay. You feel pretty comfortable with this? Would you like a few more practice problems? Okay, let's do one more. Let's do, say, a PO2 of 42 and body temperature is normal.
Low 70s.
Yeah, somewhere in the 70s, 73, 75 sounds good. Okay, so which line did you use? The center one, good. And now what happens to your percent saturation if you shift left?
Increases
saturation. So what happens to the oxygen? Stays bound to hemoglobin, right. What happens if you stay at 42 and you shift right? Decrease percent saturation. So what number do you think you go to?
65,
low to mid 60s, yeah. So your oxygen now is diffusing out into cells and tissues getting used, so we decrease saturation. So just kind of as a rule of thumb, shifting right decreases your saturation of hemoglobin. Shifting left will increase your saturation with more oxygen. Okay. How about any other questions on the curve?
Can you say that again? Decreases right.
Yeah, shift right, you decrease saturation of hemoglobin. And if you shift left, you increase saturation. Meaning we let more oxygen bind to hemoglobin. So shift right decreases saturation, shift left will increase saturation. Sure. All right, what's your next question? Do know the hepatic portal circulation, yeah. It's a couple things to make sure you know. Hepatic portal vein takes blood into the liver. Hepatic vein takes blood away from the liver. And then, of course, you want to know the steps that are involved there. It's a multiple choice, if I remember correctly.
What page is that?
Oh, let's see. That is...
94.
Thank you. We covered a lot of distance in between those two topics. Tomorrow I've got the 9:30 and the 11 o'clock on main campus. They're in rooms 54 and 1, both of them back to back in there.
They are wrapping up metabolism, and then they too have open Q&A periods. You guys are welcome to come. 9:30 and 11, both rows 54 and 1. They're going to wrap up metabolism, and then the rest of their time is open Q&A. Theirs is Thursday. Sure. Hepatic portal veins take blood into the liver. Yeah, and hepatic veins take blood out of the liver toward the IVC. All right, question was to review hyper and hypoventilation. What I'd like to do is start you with just the effects, you know, so it's cause and effect. So I can stand up here and start panting for no reason, but that's going to have an effect on my blood pH. So simply changing the respiration rate influences blood pH, CO2 levels, and oxygen levels. So we'll just kind of review those first of all. If you hyperventilate for whatever reason, that's going to reduce the amount of CO2 in your bloodstream. You're panting it out. That's called hypocapnia. By breathing out CO2, you make your blood pH less acidic, and you push it more into the alkaline territory, so that sends us into alkalosis. And then finally, the faster you breathe, you're actually getting in more oxygen, and that leads us to having excess oxygen called hyperoxia. So this is simply a statement of cause and effect. If I breathe faster, these are the blood chemistry changes we expect to see. Likewise, if you're breathing really slow, like if you're doing yoga or for whatever reason you're purposely breathing slower, or maybe you're breathing slower as a compensation, we expect to see these kinds of chemistry changes. The slower you breathe, the more you keep carbon dioxide. That's called hypercapnia. What is the relationship between carbon dioxide and blood pH?
Hydrogen ions.
Hydrogen ions, right. The more CO2 you keep, the more hydrogen ions you create, and those hydrogen ions bring your blood pH down into acidosis. And then finally, the slower you breathe, the less oxygen you get into your bloodstream. We call that condition hypoxia. Okay, so these are just what happens to our blood pH if you alter your respiration rate faster or slower. Now, let's take it the next step, because we know that these kinds of breathing rate changes can act as a compensation for respiratory problems or, you know, blood chemistry problems, metabolic problems. So let's take that one step further. All right, let's say that we have a case of ketoacidosis. Ketoacidosis can come from a breakdown of fats and proteins, and that breakdown process makes excess hydrogen ions. Well, those hydrogen ions are picked up by the chemoreceptors. That's your stimulus, right? And these chemoreceptors take that information to your brainstem, specifically to the pons and the medulla. What is the control center that receives that information? Respiratory center, yes. So the respiratory center makes a decision, and the respiratory center sends out a nerve impulse by way of the phrenic nerve in your neck. What is the message to your phrenic nerve?
Breathe faster.
Breathe faster, right? Increase respiration. So we now send a message down to your diaphragm, the intercostal muscles, to breathe faster. How does this fix the stimulus?
Blow off the CO2 and the hydrogen ions.
Good. Blow off the excess CO2, and that takes with it those hydrogens, and so your respiration rate increases to help return your blood chemistry back to normal. Okay? Let's do another one. Let's say that you've taken a bunch of antacids, which are alkaline in nature. The stimulus is you now have metabolic alkalosis, and with metabolic alkalosis, your chemoreceptors pick up on that information in your carotid arch, common carotid arteries, and your aortic arch. Where is this information taken for processing?
Brain.
Which part of your brain?
Pons and medulla.
Pons and medulla, good. And what is the name of the control center housed there?
Respiratory
center, good. Your respiratory center gets a note that says, hey, blood is too alkaline. What does your respiratory center decide to do about this?
Breathe slower,
good. So the nerve impulses coming down your phrenic nerve are going to slow, yes, and they slow down, and now your respiration rate becomes what?
Slower,
yeah, hypoventilation. So how does hypoventilation work to fix the problem?
Hold on to
the CO2. More CO2, and that turns into
hydrogens.
Yeah, and now your blood pH will be lowered, which helps to combat our initial problem of alkalosis. Okay, so just want to make a note here that, you know, with these two issues, we haven't had an O2 problem, we've had a pH problem. So we're working on pH balance, not on oxygen. But oxygen does become a primary stimulus when we hit what critically low number?
60.
Yeah, so when we hit 60 millimeters mercury, now oxygen becomes your primary stimulus for breathing. All right, so let's say that we're dealing with a partial pressure of 50 millimeters mercury. All right, so that's our chemoreceptors picking up on that stimulus once again. We take the information to our respiratory center. What happens to the respiration rate in compensation?
Speeds up,
good. So we hyperventilate. How does that help our initial problem?
Get more oxygen in,
right. So we pull more oxygen in because we know that hyperventilation can lead to hyperoxia. And that's what we want to do. We want to get more oxygen into the bloodstream. All right, would you like one more to try? I'll talk you through this one. Let's say that we're exercising and we have excess CO2. Okay, so I'll let you take a moment to either mentally map that out or map it out on paper. We're exercising and we have excess CO2. Okay, had a chance to think it through. So, of course, the chemoreceptors pick up on the information. What does the respiratory center decide to do about this?
Breathe
faster, good. So the phrenic nerve takes a message more quickly back down to the diaphragm and intercostals. Do you hyper or hypoventilate?
Hyperventilate,
right. So how does hyperventilation help your problem? Get rid of the CO2 more quickly, right? Breathe faster, get out that CO2. So the compensation can work to get rid of or get more of a gas to help alter blood pH or O2 levels or CO2 levels. How do you feel about this concept, this hyper and hypoventilation stuff? Getting there? Okay. I have found in the past that, you know, it's like riding a bike. People either get it and they ride that bike on the test or they don't. So if you are at all sitting on the fence on this topic, you want to be sure to ride that bike till Wednesday and make sure you get this thing down pat. And if you need to talk it through with me, feel free to come by, email me. I'll be happy to send you more examples and you can send me back your answers. Or you're welcome to come to that class tomorrow and ask more questions on it. But you know, this is definitely a topic where you've got to ride that bike and get this down pat.
Do we need to know the food sources for the vitamins?
Don't worry about that. Yeah, don't worry about food sources.
So should we focus on deficiencies of the vitamins?
Yeah, look at where you might have a deficiency. And the more common ones, like spina bifida.
And highlight the scurvy, like you was talking about with the sailors and stuff.
Yes, scurvy's a good one. B12 with pernicious anemia is a good one. We talked about that a lot.
Right.
Yeah.
I have another question.
Sure.
One of the questions on one of the quizzes was, does CO2 bind to the same receptor site as oxygen? I couldn't find it in our...
Let me give you the page number. It does not. It binds to the amino acids and forms something called carbaminohemoglobin. So there's no competition there. That's on page 80 under number 2 near the top of the page. Page 80. So yeah, it typically does not bump off oxygen or compete for a C. What's your next topic?